This episode of the Citadel Cafe is brought to you by Starcrossed Volume 1, available for pre-order now on Indiegogo.com. Starcrossed Volume 1 is the first collection of Starcrossed comics by me, Joel Duggan. With over 80 pages of comics and content, the book is a must-have for Starcrossed fans. The pre-order packages have lots of extra goodies, including Starcrossed swag, sketches, and original comic strip artwork. All of the funds raised in the pre-order process will be used to print and ship the first edition of the book, so go out and get your copy today and help make Starcrossed Volume 1 a success. For more information, visit Indiegogo.com/StarCrossedVolume1.
This is the Citadel Cafe.
This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 36, recorded live Wednesday, September 26th, 2012. I am Joel Duggan of StarCrossedOnline.com. To my right is Mr. Peyton Francis of CardboardTreehouse.com. Peyton, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing very well. I'm very well indeed. Thanks for having me, guys.
Back again. I think it's been another one of those weeks where I haven't talked to you since the last time we did the show.
I know. It's just been crazy busy.
So. Yeah, I feel you. I'm in the same boat. Lots of holes, small bucket. You know, doing the best that I can. Yeah. To my other right is none other than Mr. Ryan Murphy of the Gamers In podcast, filling in for Chad this week. Welcome to the show, Ryan.
Thank you for having me once again. Happy to be back and happy to inject more games into the Citadel Cafe. But I guess you probably will be able to help me out with that today.
Yes, for this particular week, I will be able to help you out with that kind of stuff. Yes, I'm looking forward to actually talking a little video games on the other side of TCC this week. The show, if you happen to be new to it, is where we three come to hang out to talk about the things that we've been into lately. We gravitate towards, you know, geeky sci-fi, sometimes video games, fantasy stuff, but we're not myopic. We talk about anything from movies, television, books, apps, websites, you name it. If it passes through our wheelhouse and we think it's cool, we will let you know. So I've got a bunch of stuff to start off the show with before we get into the thick of things. First, I want to say a happy 29th birthday to listener and friend Callum McLeod. His birthday was yesterday, but we don't record on Tuesdays, so I'm wishing him happy birthday today. Arguably a bigger deal, he and my friend Helen are getting married this Sunday. So double congrats to those cats. We will see you at the scene of the reception on Sunday. And thanks for the invite. Both Justin and I are going to enjoy a night off and just kind of relax in someone else's, you know, super cool event. And I'm looking forward to sharing that with them. The other big news is that Starcrossed Volume 1 is funded.
Woohoo! That's awesome, man.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you very much. Over the weekend, a very generous reader and friend pushed the Indiegogo goal over the original limit. So it is 100% happening. Everybody that has helped out, I thank you very, very much. I am humbled and flattered and excited to be able to bring this book to you guys. And now, because there's still 8 days, I think, left in the campaign, I've inserted some stretch goals. So the way that this works is that if the campaign reaches these next sets of goals, then upgrades will happen to the book. I will print it with better paper. I will print it with a nicer cover. All of the things that are currently being done for the book are great. They're all kind of standard stuff that you'd see in books, you know, standard cover, standard book stock. But it's just that extra mile to really make it a really pristine reading experience, you know, because it's a lot of art, you know, obviously in the book for comics. So it's not quite the same as just reading a paperback. So unfortunately, once you get into like laminate covers and all this other kind of stuff, printing gets very expensive. So hence the stretch goals. So if anybody out there has friends or family or anybody on their social networks that thinks they might be interested in the book, pass it along. Because if the stretch goals are met, then everybody, including all the folks that have already contributed, of course, benefit because the book will just be printed with some higher quality stock. So I am really close to the first stretch goal, actually. It's only $50 away, maybe less than that. So
yeah, you'll be hitting that one.
So. I hope so. I hope so. So thank you again to everybody. I really appreciate all of that support. It's very exciting as an independent artist to be self-publishing your own book, thanks to, you know, readers and fans and stuff like that. It's a very, very cool feeling, and I'm looking forward to making it. That's also the reason why I've been so busy, is because I'm putting the final touches on the book, and I'm a perfectionist, and I'm staying up late at night doing it after I finish my client work during the day, so it's kind of eating into my sleep time, etc. But hopefully it will all be worth it in the end. And another thank you has to go out, which will lead right into Ryan's wanting to talk about video games, because originally I wasn't going to be able to take part in the new World of Warcraft expansion, at least not right away, because we just can't afford it. Things are really tight right now. We're trying to do our best to penny pinch, and there's some video games that you just like, well, $40 is $40, and then there's two of us, so it's $80, and it all adds up really fast, and so we weren't going to be able to play. Well, Jocelyn and I have a friend in the States. His name is Todd. Todd Eaton. I like to call him War Crusher because that's the handle that he goes by in Warcraft, and it's super fun to say on the radio. He, the generous son of a gun that he is, bought us and gifted us expansions for the game.
Nice.
So yeah, wow. He sent one to Jocelyn, one to me, and as far as I'm concerned, this whole episode of the Citadel Cafe is brought to you by Todd Eaton of the U.S., also known as War Crusher. So I'm stoked because I've upgraded. I have made my panda, and I'm ready to be, you know, part of the whole panda.
You look pretty badass.
Pandaverse, actually. Yes. I'm a Pandaren monk, just like everybody else that's going to be joining this little expansion. Little. I say little in quotation marks, but
I saw a funny thing on Facebook yesterday from one of the girls I used to go to school with, and she was saying that she was preparing to join the millions of WoW widows who will be sitting by while all their partners are, you know, squealing in glee, trying to be the first ones to hit level 90, right?
Yeah, well, that's the thing that I like about my experience with Warcraft so far, is that it's Jocelyn's first time through. So she wants to take her time and read quests and stuff like that. And we've mentioned this before on the show that, you know, when we play Warcraft together, it's kind of like a date night and it's kind of like a road trip. So we really enjoy just taking our time, reading the quests, you know, reading the stories. Why are we going to collect these mushrooms? Why are we killing these wild boars, you know, outside the orphanage? All this kind of stuff.
Is it the right move for my character?
Yeah, exactly. So I guess I can just jump in since I'm talking about it. I'm currently a Pandaren monk named Pondus. The notes here for the show say that I was tiptoeing back and forth on what name to pick. And so far, I mean, since I've reserved all the names, I've jumped in and said, Pondus is my monk. And what I like about it is that it's Latin for weight or has weight. I didn't even have to mash up any words and make something up. It actually is just a straight up Latin translation. So that was really fun. The other name that I was toying around with was, Xinjin, which is half of the Chinese word for soul, and then the other, the jin part is bear. And Jocelyn's character is Taojin, which means bouncy bear, which I thought was super funny.
She's a gummy bear.
Yeah, well, a gummy bear or a care bear. Like, all of the names we were throwing around the other night sounded like care bears. That's where we are. We haven't done anything. We logged in long enough to see the little fly through over the starting zone. We started our monastery. I landed and then I logged out because I've got just too much stuff to do. So I just, you know, I'm there to say that I'm there. And then hopefully we'll be able to hook up with some people from AIE and play with them later on. So Ryan, what has been your experience so far with Mists of Pandaria?
Well, you know, I started a monk like everybody else and I named him Pengi. I suck at naming characters, so I just hit like the randomize button.
And that came out, wow.
Yeah, well, I think they've changed it. So when you hit the randomize button, it checks the server because there's a little query wait signal that comes up.
Okay.
So I hit it until I found one that I liked and I hit create and it worked. I remember in the past when you did that, it was like a text file that it looked at and it would constantly fail out. But I got him to level 11 or so today. Chose Horde, obviously. And I am on the AIE server as well. So made sure to stay on the AIE side just so I don't have a whole guild coming after me.
10,000 people.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll probably join once I'm trying to see whether I'm going to go serious with this guy, because I have a level 60 on that server as well.
Oh, I see.
So we'll see. But I'm training to be a healer. I've never been able to play a healer, so I'm looking forward to trying that out.
Right on. Well, there's definitely room for you with Jocelyn and I, because I'm playing a tank and she's a hunter for our mains on the server. Mm-hmm. I'm doing DPS monk, and I think she can't decide whether she wants to do tank DPS or healer DPS on the monk side of things. It's an interesting class. We haven't quite figured out exactly how it's going to work yet, but it looks like it's got a lot of versatility to it.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It feels different in the sense that, and I remember they made a big deal about this at last year's BlizzCon, in the sense that there's no auto attack. Like, you're always hitting buttons to make moves and stuff.
Right on.
Yeah, so it just feels, it's different from other MMOs where you can just sit there and push a button and wait and push a button. This one, you're like constantly tapping buttons to make them do moves and stuff.
Well, I know what that's like. I was myself, John Beck and his wife, Sandy, and then, Todd, Warcrusher, and Jocelyn and I, were all in, we ran a couple dungeons the other night on the weekend. Took some time off after a long day of work to chill out. And it was actually our first run through a real dungeon. Like, we did two of them, and both of them were around our level. So it was quite challenging, even with the five man that we had going on. Especially the second one. We didn't realize it at first, but we were like, man, why are we getting... Because we wiped like three or four times in the second dungeon, and don't ask me what names they were. One was a castle in the we're level 40, and it was a castle type place in the northern plague lands or the eastern plague lands.
Was it Shadowfang?
No, we've already done Shadowfang. But Shadowfang Keep, we were so high level for that dungeon that Jocelyn and I just did it, the two of us. Whereas this one, it was much, much tougher. But we wiped a few times on the second dungeon that we tried. And then they realized that I was level 42 and I was the tank. And I was tanking elite 46 and 44s.
Oh.
And I was having kind of a hard time with it. Like, I knew what I was supposed to be doing, but I mean, I was just by a hair, you know, getting through some of these encounters. And then John was like, oh my God, you're only level 42. I was like, well, yeah, we knew this going in. He's like, oh, well, crap. No wonder we're having a hard time keeping, you know, aggro on the tank. So once we figured that out, we changed the approach a little bit. We started, you know, trying to pick our fights a little bit better. And we ended up getting through, and the boss fights were easy. It was the mob fights that were hard. But it was a good experience, and I had a lot of pats on the back for, you know, being able to tank above my level for my first time, like, really tanking. Like, I had no idea what I was doing. I mean, I wasn't leading the raid, or the dungeon. It was John that knew what we were doing. And it was a super, super fun experience. So from what I'm hearing everybody else talk about Mist of Pandaria is that it takes all that stuff that everybody has done to death and just really expands on it. It really makes it a different game. It doesn't feel like you're just going to collect, you know, four things and come back to a guy and then they send you in the other direction. Like, it's supposed to be a lot more interwoven as far as story and quests and all that kind of things are.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I experienced from the intro section. It's just 10 levels and it really feels like it's a whole story and it propels you forward, and all the quests are sort of like in the same area. So you're always doing, you're not like going off in this direction for that quest and this direction for the other quest. It's more focused, and lots of VO, which is great. The important stuff is told to you.
Oh, and, cool.
Yeah. But you also have the ability to read quest text.
Yeah. See, that's the thing that I really enjoyed about playing Mass Effect for the first time versus Warcraft, is that I really like listening to the story as opposed to reading it.
Mm-hmm.
It just, I get more involved. I get sucked in that way. So Peyton, I feel like we're probably talking, you know, gibberish, you know, outside of the box a little bit. Do you have any questions about Pandaria? Does anything kind of pique your interest about the expansion?
No.
Okay. No, I just want to make sure we haven't lost you.
Nothing really add to it. So.
No. I know. I just I figured we're. I mean, I know you're not playing. I know you're not a Warcraft player, but I thought I would just see if you had anything.
Are you able to bring your existing characters into that world, or is it just like a whole new game?
No. Yeah, you can bring your existing characters into it. Like, I mean, the patch that came out 2 weeks ago, it installed expansion elements throughout the entire game. So, like, there's Pandarans in the city that I'm currently in, and they're selling stuff and selling beer and doing their thing. And
so if you're, like, a level 70 horde, could you just, like, roll up in one of their small towns and start butchering everybody or something, or what?
On a PvP server, you probably could, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there'd be NPCs to deal with, but yeah. Non-player characters.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Acronym C.
So I guess the non-player characters would be there to help prevent that sort of thing from running amok.
Yeah, pretty much.
Like, yeah. They're just sort of bully stoppers.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Ryan, have you ever played on a PvP server?
I have. My first server was a PvP, and you're right. It's very interesting. I don't know if you've been to Booty Bay yet. It's like it's the very southern tip of the... Oh,
yep.
Man, it's been so long. But anyways...
Yep. Of the Eastern Kingdoms, yep.
Right, and it's a free-for-all zone in the sense that there's no alliance or horde sort of bias. It's neutral, it's all goblin-y, and going through the questing in there is sort of the first point where you are questing with the other faction. And there's always a chance that someone's going to come up behind you and kill you. You know, so you have to, it's like you have to have eyes on the back of your head, and you always have to have an escape route. Like, if I kill these four tigers, am I going to be able to have enough health to get away from the rogue who's questing just over the hill? You know, so PvP servers are interesting, and a lot of people see them as hard mode. So if you play on a PvE or RP server, you're quote-unquote a noob to a PvP person.
Right.
Which I don't necessarily find true. I mean, I'd rather just have fun. And, hey, a little RP never killed anybody, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Another question is, and now it's gone. never mind.
Why is there air? Well, Peyton...
No, it was... Oh, yeah, no, I know what I was going to ask them. Is Leroy Jenkins still in the game?
I have no idea.
I think, I don't know. He's a meme. He's an NPC they put him in, but I don't know where he is.
Oh, no, I've never run into him or his NPC.
I think he might have been, he would have been either Burning Crusade or Wrath. Like, this was, the meme is old. It's old, like 5 years old, I think.
Oh, yeah,
at this
easily.
Point. So if the NPC still is in there, it's like a couple expansions ago. I could be wrong, but.
Right on. Okay, well, I guess we can move into movies, TV, and video. And Peyton, since you've been on the quiet side, not being a Warcraft player, what's been on the TV screen for you this week?
Nothing really new other than there's a new season of the show Face Off on Space.
Oh, the makeup one.
Yeah, special effects makeup for movies and films. So it's a pretty neat show. And again, I watch it on spacecast.com. Space Channel's TV show. So they show the last few episodes there. And I think they're up to episode 6 now. And I guess guest judges come in and stuff. I think the top prize is like $100,000. And then they also get the guest lecture at 2 different schools, one in Paris and one somewhere else. And they also get a car, which is, you know, it's fun. Plus you get the recognition of, you know, of winning that sort of competition. So
yeah, that's pretty cool.
Anyway, yeah, so they, you know, they get a couple of days to do some makeup on some sort of theme. And there's one guy there, I can't remember what his name is, an older fella, but he's just kicking ass all over the place. He's a super fast fabricator, and he like made full-on cyborg and all this stuff. It's really, really neat.
Wow.
And but now they're also expanding. The producers of that are making another one called Hot Set, which is going to be all about making sets for movies in a limited time frame based on a theme. Same sort of idea. So we'll see how that that turns out. So, yeah, it's fun stuff. And also over the weekend, Joel and I, we watched that Pascal Campion webinar, which was pretty neat.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. I mean, it was not, it's hard to say exactly what you would call it. You called it correctly here, I think, a webinar. They were advertising it as a workshop, and it was not really a workshop.
Yeah, yeah, it was more like watching a podcast.
Yes.
Like Escape from Illustration on or something like that, where they talk a bit about technique, and then he did a very quick quick piece, which was really informative, because I actually been playing with that as part of my warm-ups in the morning, which is nice.
Yeah. I wish he had done more of that. I wish he had been able to... I mean, he's probably one of those guys that can't really draw and talk at the same time. Like, I find that challenging, you know, just to kind of... If you're going to focus in and do something super quick, like the way that you normally work, it's kind of difficult sometimes to talk about it as you go.
Yeah, you know, it was neat to see his working method, you know, working within Flash, which his approach to a lot of the things are similar to how I do things. So.
Oh, cool.
But he's much, much faster, of course. It was astounding to watch how fast he was. I was like, this isn't a sped up video or something, is it? Because he was just burning through it, right?
But, yeah, no, and that was real time. I mean, there might have been a little bit of a lag. You know, like we might have missed like an undo stroke or a correction or something like that, given the lag. But one of the things that actually impressed me was the GoToMeeting webinar software that they were using was, I mean, pretty bang on. It was not not too laggy. I'm just using that as maybe a possible excuse when he started drawing and taxing his system. But the slideshow that they had going and the audio connection and the the response time between like asking a question to the moderator and having them bring that into the conversation for Pascal was really nil. So it was a really solid
setup. It was 70 participants in the chat room, and I think the max you can have is 500 or so.
Something like that, yeah. For the capacity that they've paid for with GoToWebinar. The question that I have, were you able to figure out when the other question and answer sessions are going to happen? Because they've posted some already. They've done some, and they've posted them on their YouTube channel for the CGWA?
I think so.
Computer Graphics something Alliance? I can't remember. Anyway, Masterworks Alliance. Anyway, they're basically doing Q&As with all of the instructors that they have for their fall-winter sessions. So, like, Pascal, you can sign up to take, like, a 6 or 8 week course from him for, like, $600, where he's the instructor. He lectures once a week, you do projects, he then reviews them, gives you like actual breakdown pointers. And it's really invaluable to have that opportunity to sit down and listen to your teacher lecture or be interviewed for an hour before you decide to drop the money for the course. You know,
they do similar things with schoolism as well, which is the one that Silver is involved with.
Silver and Bobby Chu. And those guys, I think there's one other guy that's a big name, but his name is escaping me at the moment. But yeah, I mean, I liked it. I think they just had to be careful with advertising it as a workshop, because there certainly was not a lot of interactivity between the 60, 70 people in the chat room and Pascal. I feel like the moderator had some questions. Now, whether he was getting them privately from the chat room or whether he had a list of them drawn up beforehand, I don't know.
Yeah, well, again, it's a free workshop or free webinar with the goal of raising the profile of the school and getting that information out there. So
right on.
Yeah. So,
yeah. Anyway. Well, that's also one of the things that I took in. I hadn't put it down because I actually watched quite a bit this week. Surprisingly, I guess it's just that I need that little bit of time before I go to bed to switch the brain off. You know, like I need to just kind of sit down and relax and de-workify before I try to get some sleep. And I had a date night with Jocelyn, and we decided to watch Hugo on Netflix. It's streaming in Canada. And we hadn't seen it. We'd heard lots of good things about it. So we just thought, well, let's just throw it on. You know, like we're trying to pull the trigger on things on Netflix that we want to see. There's just so much choice. I mean, even in Canada, where the choice is limited, there's just so much that you can choose from. And we find that we sit there for 20 minutes trying to decide what movie we actually want to do, actually want to watch. So it's really, we've been trying to just like, all right, we've got 10 minutes. And top of the heap in 10 minutes is what we're watching. It's only Netflix. We're already paying for it. If it sucks, we just can just turn it off and go do something else. So we watched Hugo, and I mean, it's well made. It's a beautiful film technically, but you can only craft boring and predictable so many ways before I lose interest. And I didn't know a lot about the movie going in. I hadn't seen many trailers. I only heard like several comic friends raving about it online, and I was trying to figure out what the feeling was throughout the whole movie. And it finally dawned on me closer to the end. And it was exactly what it felt like was exactly what it was. It felt like Scorsese made a kid's movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, that's exactly what I knew was going to happen, but it felt so odd. And it got really preachy at the end about like the dawn of filmmaking and movie magic and all these things that Scorsese really cares about and all the power to him. But like, I don't know that maybe a 10-year-old would be entertained in this kid's movie, but I mean, like, but Jocelyn and I, we liked it. It wasn't bad, but it was just blah, for the lack of a better way to describe it. I was underwhelmed, I guess, is my final verdict on it. Have either one of you guys seen it?
No.
No, I haven't, but I'm curious. I think this is one of the movies that came out last year that they were touting as, you know, a really good 3D movie, if that makes And yeah. I know that doesn't make a difference since you watched it on Netflix, but I'm curious if you could see that in watching it in 2D, whether it's like, oh, this is almost like a weird whoa moment, you know?
There was maybe one or two of those moments where you knew something was flying at the screen. Or okay. It was supposed to be a, hey, look how cool we can do this. But they really did not do very much of it. I would imagine, the basic plot is that Hugo is this kid that's living in a train station and he looks after clocks. So it's all kind of, I want to say post-First World War stuff, like the 30s maybe. And there's a lot of clockwork. Like there's all the toys are like wind up spring toys and there's a lot of like fixing automatons clocks.
Automatons and sort of thing. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. So I can understand using 3D for really crisp depth of field and detail. And if they did that well, then yeah, that would be pretty cool. I can see that as a visual experience. But even then, like that doesn't fix the story. Like that doesn't change the subject matter.
It was based off a popular book, so...
Yeah, well, exactly.
I remember I tried to read it one time because a friend of mine, Frances, I used to work with, she had it, and she really was talking highly of it, and I just couldn't get through it.
So. There's a lot of really awkward moments in the first little bit. So, I mean, if you decide to try to watch it and it turns you off, stick with it at least to halfway. Because we were... With the first 30 minutes, we were like, I don't know. Like, are we going to last through this whole thing? Because it's 2 hours. And... the awkward part is that the kid Hugo he's alone, so he doesn't socialize very well. And the actor that plays him is very, very talented and does a good job of making you feel awkward with him. But he also looks really strange. He's like a combination of Paul, is it Rampt? The guy that's in the comedies with everybody, the blue-eyed guy, I can't remember his name.
Paul Rudd?
Rudd, thank you, okay. Paul Rudd. So it's Paul Rudd, and then the guy that plays Professor Crane in the Batman movies. So you've got like, you know, you've got attractive little blue-eyed kid versus creepy, creepy, like eyes set very far apart, kind of, you know, blank stare character at you. And it has this very off-putting mechanism when he does it. It's very odd. And of course everybody's British and there's lots of acting with no talking. So it can be very, you know, I don't know. I've said awkward several times, but it's not the same type of movie making that I'm used to, I guess. So, I mean, I can say that, you know, I grew a little bit maybe watching the movie. Maybe it's, you know, time to open up my eyes to some movies like this, but I wasn't overly taken by it. But the other two things that I've taken in this week have been much shorter. Framerate 94, which is one of my favorite podcasts. Framerate episode 94, by the way. It's a podcast that covers a lot of the set-top boxes, alternative media viewing, and stuff like that. And they get together with the NSFW show, and they do the winter and summer movie drafts. And what this is they all get together, they have a certain amount of money for each person involved, and then they have an auction where they buy certain movies for X amount of dollars. So like, say, Peyton, you bid $17 on the new James Bond movie, and maybe I spent $65 on The Hobbit. And then they all compete over the course of the winter movie releases as to who's making the most money domestically over a set period of time.
Okay.
So there's a wager going on between the people involved. And they also open it up to the public. So you can go to draft.nsfwshow.com/forum/smart-entry-forum. And you can take part. The way that it's working for audience members is that all of the movies now have specific values. I think The Hobbit went for 60. I think James Bond went for 17 or 33 or something like that. So you can only purchase these movies for what their current value is. So, for example, I picked The Hobbit and Les Mis just for fun, just to see how that kind of pairing actually does financially. Because everybody kind of knows that The Hobbit is going to make a lot of money. But
Twilight's going to make a lot of money.
Well, exactly. And Twilight went for a lot of, Twilight was like $65 or $67 or something like that in the draft. So, it's a really neat way to kind of get everybody on board for what can be kind of a boring winter movie session. And the, the show, the actual episode, the whole thing was just 6 or 8 tech friends hanging out and bidding on movies. And it was hilarious. Like, because, I mean, no one's really following show notes. Like, just everybody's just kind of goofing off and making jokes and trying to one-up one another, like waiting until the auctioneer says, going once, going twice. And then somebody bids, you know, $1 more, and it just keeps on climbing. And, you know, everybody's trying to hold out for the kids' movies because they know they're going to be doing well and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, it was a fun episode to watch. The link is in the show notes. I'm going to throw it in the chat room there, too, in case everybody...
Sounds like sort of like you're buying stocks in the movie.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what it's like. It was really quite fun. I enjoyed having a change of pace, you know, because I didn't really know they were going to... They do this, but I didn't realize that they recorded and televised the auction process. Maybe that might be a new thing.
I just look at the site here now. They've got The Rise of the Guardians of DreamWorks film at 8, and then they've got Frankenweenie at 13.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, right. it depends on what the strategies are of all the people involved. I mean, like, if you and I did the draft, it might not have turned out that way. And people aren't necessarily bidding on movies that they think are going to be good. They're bidding on movies that they think are going to make money, which is why Twilight went for so much, because, I mean, that thing is going to make, you know, tons of money.
Scads money.
Exactly. So, and the last thing that I watched was a short-ish YouTube clip called Epic Dragon Con Cosplay.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I found it via Chinbeard on Twitter, who is our friend Bill Duran, who was at Nerdtacular this year, and he is a costume fabricator, which I'm pretty sure he does full-time from home now, and he does wicked, wicked stuff. Like, he does his own injection molding and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, the video speaks for itself. It's simply a high-def video, and definitely watch it at the full 1080p. Watch people walk around in costume at Dragon Con 2012. You know, it's bits of awesome, bits of not so awesome, but mostly bits of awesome.
But the not so awesome is even awesome.
Yeah, well, just, you have to give people props for anything that they've done. I mean, some people, it's really homemade and it's really not that well done, but you can still see the effort that they put into it. Like, it still took them, you know, 4 weekends to find all the stuff and put it all together. I mean, some people come in and they look like they're, you know, professional costumers, and I mean, they look great, but you're just like, well, you've got access that people don't always have, you know?
Yeah.
But there's some really, really cool costumes that have been floating around. And, Jocelyn and I are going to try to go to Dragon Con next year. It's really close to HalCon, so I'm not sure how that's going to balance out financially, but it's on the list of things we'd want to do. So, Ryan, what have you been watching, sir?
I don't know if you guys watched The Office. It's been around for a very long time. You might not have heard of it.
I haven't really paid much attention to it. I watched the original British version, but anyway.
Oh, man, I actually have a funny story about that. But the Office, they started the new season, the American version. It's actually going to be the last season.
Okay.
So they're wrapping it all up. And I just thought it was interesting. Usually, if it was a standard Office, I wouldn't mention it. But because it's the last season, they're sort of creating new storylines to basically send off all the characters as the series finishes off. And it's as funny as it ever was, but it's interesting to see what they're going to be doing. Like, they say that they're going to bring, well, I guess this could be spoilers, but they're bringing back old characters that have left the series. It was very highly publicized that Michael Scott, or wait, what's his real name? That's embarrassing. The comedian dude, Steve Carell.
Oh, Steve Carell, yeah.
Yeah, he left the show after his contract was up, and actually he's going to be coming back for a couple episodes to sort of wrap up his character, and you're actually going to find out what the documentary crew is doing at the paper company. They've been there for 8 seasons, now on their 9th, and we still don't know why they're filming, and we still don't even know who they are. Actually, it was funny. In the first episode, you actually hear them talk and see them on camera. I mean, no faces, just like people. Whereas in seasons prior, it was always this, like, basically the cameraman was this silent character that you never saw or never heard. So they're sort of shifting more towards a documentary rather than just a sitcom. So you're actually seeing, like, the interactions between the character and the person behind the camera. So it's interesting. And I guess being the last season, if you were ever a fan, or if you started watching and stopped, it might be a good idea to come back, because you'll be seeing their best work, basically, I guess.
Oh, cool.
But you mentioned the British series, and I actually watched the first episode, and I don't know whether the American version has ruined it, but I'm going to get some hate here, but I couldn't get into it. Like, the British version was sort of like, man, someone call HR on this guy. It's even worse than the American version.
Yeah, the phrase, you know, just awkward is awkward and uncomfortable, and you're just like, will you please stop? Right? And as you're watching it, you're like, come on, man, just give it up, right?
Yeah. Anyway. Now, I mean, points of it were funny, but it was, like you said, it was more so just, I don't know if I can get into this. It's sort of like, I don't know. It's not as funny as the IT crowd, I guess, where IT crowd was awkward, but had more like slapstick funny stuff in between the awkward. Mm. So, I mean, it's very hard to get into British TV for me for some reason, but I don't know. I'll keep an eye on The Office, and I'm kind of happy to see it go because I want to see how it ends. I just want it to be over with, right? Nine seasons is a long time.
Yeah. Jocelyn watched several episodes of the first season of the British Office, which is on Netflix now. And she said the same thing, Peyton. She was like, oh, awkward, like really very, very British, very dry, very awkward. Mm-hmm. But she's like, it's also the same script as the first season of the American Office. Yeah. So all the character names are the same, I think. And all of the relationships and storylines are the same, at least for the first season. Yeah. So she found it hard to get into, having already seen the American version. Brian, how do you feel about the reveal of the documentary stuff? Is that cool? Do you think it's better off left as a big mystery? You know, it's kind of like how Firefly is a giant hit, and one could argue that it's that popular because it didn't end. Like, because it got cut short, like, there was no wrap-up, there was no finality to it. You know, like, there was, with the British Office, there's just three seasons, I think, and they're short.
Yeah, I think they had two series and a couple of holiday specials.
Something so, like yeah, that, yeah.
Netflix reports it as, I think, maybe 20 episodes.
Right, so, but it leaves you hanging. Like, there's no real conclusion, you know, it just kind of happened.
Yeah, and yeah, it doesn't resolve relationships. It didn't get canceled. They just stopped. Whereas with American TV, when they end something, I don't know, we're just a different audience. Like, I don't want to say we care more, because I'm sure the British care about their TV, but we almost see it as unfair when we don't know what happens to our characters, I guess. So I am kind of happy to see what's going on, but I don't want, like, slapstick McGee to walk out from behind the camera and say, I've been feeling you the whole time. You know, I want...
it's all I just been want a dream.
yeah, exactly. No, we don't want that now.
Yeah.
We don't want Lost, and we don't want a Lost ending for The Office, right? Mm-hmm. But I think I'll be happy to see what's going on and just the reasoning behind it, because following... That's the other thing about the British Office. Following the British Office for, you know, a year to make two series makes sense as a documentary. Following a company for like 9 years, 10 years does not make any sense for making a documentary. So it'll be interesting to see how they explain that, or if they even bother. I think that's my reasoning for wanting to figure this all out.
Maybe it's the world's longest audit.
Yeah. It's just the government, and then it ends with them closing.
Yeah.
That's
your
funny.
Books are not in order. That's it.
Yes. Oh man. Right on. Well, I guess we can actually move on into the reading section. I've got a quick post to talk about here. It's been all over the internet today, and I had to go and read the details because everybody's been raving about this. I think a lot of us are familiar with MakerBot, if you're living in the same internet circles that I am, which is the 3D printer that you can now own and sit on your desk. And MakerBot 2 was just announced at, what's that big conference called in January? I'm drawing a blank. It's in Las Vegas.
CES one?
CES, thank you. Consumer Electronics Show. And Bree Pettis was interviewed on Twit, and there was lots of information about it. And there's a new kid on the block as far as affordable home 3D printers are. Formlabs has created a low-cost, light-based 3D printer. So the MakerBot is an extrusion-based machine. So basically, it spits stuff out. And in order to do that, it has layers, and each layer is 100 microns thick. Formlabs uses stereolithography, so it uses UV light to cure very thin layers of resin, and those layers are 25 microns thick or thin, I guess, depending on how you want to look at a micron,
yeah.
Which gives you a lot more detail as far as your models are concerned. And the they've got working prototypes. They're basically running a Kickstarter, Formlabs is, to get the manufacturing costs taken care of. And for the first few, they were actually offering them at something like, you know, just over 2,000 for each Formlabs printer. Now I think they're $24.99 and $26.99.
Which is a bit the same as the MakerBots.
Yeah, no, they're on par. The difference, I think, is that the MakerBot PVC plastic that gets melted and extruded is a lot cheaper than the resin. I think somewhere on a podcast today, I heard that the resin is possibly going for $150 a liter.
Okay.
I don't know how much of that is reusable. Like, I don't know after you printed your little thing that's the size of a nut or a bolt or a nickel, whether all of the resin that you printed it in is then useless, or whether it gets recycled, whether you can just continue to reuse your own resin until you're done. I'm not exactly sure how all that works. The article, which I'll throw in the chat room here, was pretty informative, but there was a couple questions that I was still kind of left with. But the higher resolution stuff is really cool. And one of the things that they used as an example was little tabletop gaming figurines, you know, like Warhammer 40K, that kind of stuff. I mean, you can basically print anything you want within a 4.9 by 4.9 by 6 inches high framework. It's just that obviously the more resin you use, the more money it's going to cost to buy the resin and all that kind of stuff. But you could do complex forms, like they were putting water through some of the things that they made, and I mean, it was very, very cool stuff.
You include moving parts in some of them as well.
So. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's like it's a very attractive machine. You know, you don't have to put it together. You don't have to be, I say you don't have to be a super geek, but you have to, I mean, you have to know how to use it, but you don't have to, like, you know, build it from scratch and have open source software and all that kind of stuff. I think they're taking a slightly different approach to the MakerBot, so it'll be really interesting to see where this goes. But the world of 3D printing is becoming a very real sort of home situation. So, I mean, I'm wondering what that means for home businesses. I'm wondering what that means for something as simple as iPhone case manufacturing.
Oh, for sure.
You know, like you could make your own thing and have it be 3D with like your name or your, you know, favorite alliance or horde character etched into the back of it. Like you could do all kinds of really cool stuff. And the other thing, of course, is the price. I mean, it's the same price as the Cintiq. So, yeah. I mean, I was able to buy the Cintiq for me because it's a niche item that not everybody needs, but it's something that as a professional artist has done wonders for my productivity. If you are the type of artist that needs a 3D printer, I mean, $2,500 for a business to spend on a 3D printer for the office is nothing.
Yeah, I know when the companies are in town you work with, they got one and I think it cost $25,000. But with that one, they can print the full color model when they're finished.
Right.
Yeah, that one uses the dust, and then they just basically, I think, HB printer heads filled with a glue or resin, and all have the color ink. So as it goes through, it just prints a very thin layer at a time. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, just it vibrates all the dust off. You dip it in a solution and it's sealed and it's good to go. So
right, I mean, and that's cool. But how much did you say it was? $20,000.
I think it was $25,000. Yeah, I think. See, but that's it's a much larger machine.
Ten times the cost. You know, I mean, that is very cool, but a barrier to entry for the home. You know,
well, for sure. And you know, for someone like me, you know, who is looking to develop, you know, stop motion, you know, material, then it'll be a great way to go in and do some of the, you know, make some of the models and that, you know, like you did with Coraline or Paranormal. You can go and you can have your faces printed out and then use those to make your molds if you need to make molds.
I never even thought about that for you. That's freaking cool.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think of it, you know, as opposed to trying to make a little lamp or make a little desk or something like that to go into it, I can just go online, buy a model of somebody for $15 and then print it.
Yeah.
To like exactly the scale I need, right?
Yeah, so. I mean, I wonder if, I mean, I'm obviously there's probably going to be some sort of market for people creating models, because I guess the barrier to entry for you would be you're not necessarily a 3D modeler.
Yeah, no, I played with it back in school and stuff, and I'm sure, you know, I given a little bit of time, you could pick it up on that. But
oh, yeah.
There's enough, you know, if you're looking at just generic stuff, you can find it out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But, you know, if I want to do full facial animation, then, you know, you go through, do it with Maya, whatever, and
yeah.
export your files. And the other one, you know, you could print off a bunch of different versions at the same time. So you could do, like, you know, maybe like 6 or 9 method positions at once on the printer, right? So
yeah.
And you know the 100 micron thick for the other one, I think would be sufficient to do what I need to do, right? So
yeah, I would think yeah. so. I know with the MakerBot, there's some sanding that has to take place afterwards.
Yeah, I think the new one. I think the new one, the Replicator 2. I think there's no sanding required. Like I watched a video on that, and they pulled off this little version of an owl, and it looked quite smooth.
Oh, right on.
You probably could buff it a little bit if you needed to, right? But
and if you've got to paint it.
Yeah.
Some characters, you know, skin or mouth or face or whatever. Yeah, like, I mean, yeah. then that might cover up whatever imperfections would be there.
Now,
anyway.
With Coraline, they use the 3D printers for the facial animation, but they had to paint them all by hand. But with Paranorman, the new printer they're using prints in color, so there's no variances between each different puppet and each mouth set and all that stuff. So, you know, you could have the same character on 3 different sets at the same time shooting simultaneously, and there's no difference. So.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
Right on. Ryan, did you see the 3D printer stuff on the internet today? Any thoughts?
Well, I did take a look at it, and you mentioned tabletop gaming, and I think that's a perfect example, especially something I can latch onto. I mean, I went to a hobby shop when I was in Niagara Falls, and then you don't see them much. And I went in there, and the guy just latched on to me and started talking to me. He saw that I was a geek. He even got my girlfriend interested, who is not a gamer, and just talking about these little minifigures and, you know, getting them grayed out and then being able to paint them yourselves. And those things are expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're talking hundreds of dollars for sets. And you're talking, you said, maybe $150 for a liter of resin. Mm-hmm. You know.
I mean, and how big are those figurines? 1.5 inches, maybe?
Yeah.
Plus, if you make them bigger, you don't have to print them solid. You can print them hollow as well.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Well, and just being able to print them yourself, you could probably save money by buying. I mean, it would take a bit, but you could save money by buying one of these 3D printers, and you could make your own custom figurines, and that would really help with the whole role-playing aspect. I mean, I've never played Warhammer before, but I assume there's some sort of role-playing aspect to it, and I think that would make... That'd make you a pretty popular person if you could have your own custom figures, right?
Well, actually, if you were a shop that actually, you know, did those games, and you had one of those on premises, you would have the gamers all coming in to hang out there and, you know, pay you a fee to custom make it on the spot.
That would pay for itself right there.
Yeah. Oh, easily.
You should open a hobby shop.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it too as opportunities for artists. I mean, like, you're going to have guys that are, there's going to be 3D modelers out there, and if you're a fan of their work, I mean, they work in the gaming industry or they do whatever, and then they've got these, you know, they want to make some extra cash on the weekends at home. And they're like, well, I model like a bat out of hell anyway. So, I mean, like, if you want me to do a custom, you know, Warhammer 40K Marine with your face on it, you know, like, I'll you know, if you provide me the stock, or I'll make one stock Marine thing as an investment on my behalf, and then I'll custom model your face, you know, and charge you, you know, $50 or whatever. And there are fanboys out there that'll, you know, latch onto that.
Yeah, I think Disney's doing that, or Universal, some studio ride place in Florida is doing that with Han Solo and Carbonite. You go in and they do a laser scan of your face. You stand in the booth, and they print out like a little styrofoam version of you and Carbonite. So.
That's awesome.
Well, yeah, there's services like that. Like, I don't know if you guys have heard of Figure Prints, but it's the same idea, but with World of Warcraft characters, where you can submit your character and get it printed. And it's a full, I guess it's like an 8-inch action figure. Not an action figure, a statue.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't heard about those guys.
And you could even use this printer, Joel, especially, you know, for characters, like action figures, you know, statues of your characters from the comic, and sell those online as like collectibles, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, that would be really cool. I mean, and Peyton, if you made a short film, then you'd have copies to sell. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily have to sell a working puppet from your film. You could just print out a static, you know, non-posable, you know, a character from the movie would be really cool too. Oh, God, that the possibilities are endless.
Well, you know, that's how Aardman did that stop motion film Dot, the world's smallest stop motion film. And they have a little girl in the film. She's only, I think it's 9 millimeters tall. And they printed it all with a digital printer, with a 3D printer. And it's all just replacement animation. So they animated the run cycle within the computer and all her movements, and then just did it with replacement animation. So,
wow, right on.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. At one point, they got her like riding on the back of a bee and stuff, right? It's crazy. It was all shot with a Nikon camera.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really, really cool. Awesome. We're checking out. So.
Yeah. Ryan, anything on your nightstand this week?
I hate to take it in a different direction. I mean, this is really interesting, but I'm a big fan of the history of video games and stuff. So when it comes to, especially when it comes to Nintendo games, I mean, if you've listened to me talk before on the Gamers Inn, I'm known for my Nintendo fanboyism. And I picked up the Kirby 20th Anniversary Collector's box set, I guess. It was about $40. And it comes with this little history booklet. I wouldn't call it a book. It's like 30 pages. And it goes through the entire history of the Kirby franchise. And I know a lot of people like Kirby. That's a little lame, but I mean, it's a Nintendo character. I mean, you guys have probably heard of Kirby at this point, correct?
Kirby is a little white guy that sucks in bad guys and then spits them back out, right?
Yeah, basically. That's the whole kind of Kirby thing. And the book has, it's not just like, oh, you know, in this game we wanted to make Kirby do this. It's more about, it shows like original product plan documents and in Japanese translated. So it looks really neat. It's nicely put together. It goes over, you know, the thought process behind, like, it's just weird. I mean, the way they come up with these games, it's so weird and quirky, and they just explain it in the oddest ways, like how they got two-player mode into a specific game. You wouldn't even think to even look into that. But no, it's just a quick little mention. I mean, I'm a huge fan of nostalgia with these old titles, and just the original product documents just makes it really interesting to read. But yeah, that I just want to mention that. I don't read a lot, so that's probably the only thing I'd mention.
Yeah, see, most of the stuff that I've been reading lately is on the internet. I mean, or an audiobook, but even then I haven't turned on the audiobook in a long time. So I know what you mean. Like, when it comes to the reading section, I always struggle to find, you know, something that I've spent enough time on that I could say, yes, this is something that I've read in the last week that I find interesting and I'd want to share. But that's really cool, because I mean I would be interested to, I mean, I didn't really spend a lot of time with Kirby, but I played the crap out of Mario and Mario Kart and those kind of titles when I was growing up with a Super Nintendo. So I mean, if I had a book of, with like, you know, art and development and how they made it, like I would find that super cool.
Well, we have a ton of books on you know, I'm behind the scenes of Pixar and all that, so it's no different than that.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
It's not weird.
Yeah.
No, I didn't say it was weird. I mean, yeah. It's just, you mentioned Mario. They actually put one out for Mario as well.
Oh, cool.
It's same sort of idea, and that one was a lot harder to get. It sold out pretty quick, and they actually had to do a second printing. But same idea, like original product documents and stuff like that, explaining the development of the Mario franchise. But yeah, it's crazy just looking back at how they made, especially how they made the games on the NES. Like, it's totally different from how they do it now, in terms of 3D gameplay and stuff.
Cool. Well, one of the things that I have been doing while I've been reading things on the internet or working late at night has been listening to some new music, and I actually have a music pick to send out to everybody this week. And it's not brand new, but it's new to me, and it's Kimbra. Vows is the name of the album. It's really good background music for cooking or like puttering around the house, drawing. Like, it's very rhythmic. It doesn't really have a lot of loud or obnoxious parts to it. It's not disruptive, but it's not going to make you kind of... There's a couple of moments where you might want to, it's kind of like it got a dance beat to it, but it's not like crazy fast techno either. There's one or two standout singles on the album. I really enjoyed the way that it kind of all meshes together. Some of the songs in the middle kind of start to sound the same, but I got through the whole album in one sitting last night or the day before. And I noticed that it starts to pick up and get a little bit more diverse near the end, the last few tracks. And I give her a lot of points for originality. She does some really neat stuff. She does a lot, well, all of, if not most of her own vocals. She has some really cool videos on YouTube if you look her up, K-I-M-B-R-A. And she does this one. She was at South by Southwest, and she's just doing like a voice beatbox remix with like one of those vocal bloopers out in a park somewhere. And I mean, immediately you can see how talented she is. So it's if you're looking for some new, slightly different stuff, then Kimbra Vows is what I have been listening to this week. Anybody else have soundtracks or music that they've been listening to?
I picked up the collector's edition for Mists of Pandaria, and it comes with...
I'm jealous. There's an art book in there, Peyton.
Okay.
The drool is foaming about the art book.
It's massive, that art book's like 200 pages.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't had a chance to look through it, but the soundtrack. Yeah, I know. I had to get the game installed. I'm a huge, probably similar to how you're frothing at the mouth for the art book. I'm always frothing at the mouth for like soundtracks to my video games. I love listening to video game music. It's actually how I get through the day at work when I'm thinking, I should be thinking about work. I'm actually thinking about wanting to play Mists of Pandaria. So to kind of counteract that, I listen to the soundtrack and it almost helps. But it was part of the collector's edition on disc, but it will soon be available on iTunes. I think they had an issue with some, like Apple pulled it or something, but it should be up there by the time people are listening to this. But WoW music is always great. And similar to what you were saying, Joel, about having background music to listen to, personally, I find orchestral music to be really easy to work with. And especially Mists of Pandaria, the music in there has like this Asian influence because of obviously the panda whatnot. And it sounds really good. And all the tracks are really great. And there's some better than others. Like obviously there's the intro song that is a play on the original WoW theme with some Asian influence in there. You probably hear it when you log in. I think it's on the home screen, but it's $10. It'll be $10 on iTunes. And I recommend it if you're into video game soundtracks, because it's one of the better ones out there.
I have one of the World of Warcraft soundtracks. I feel it might be Cataclysm, if not more than one. I had an issue with my library crashing on me, so I don't remember all of what I had. I only have what the last backup tells me I had. The music is all still there on my external. The files are still there. It's just that iTunes doesn't know that. The Cataclysm one was very, very good. I really enjoyed that. And is it Russell Brower?
Yeah, he's the composer.
Yeah, good stuff.
He also did very good on the Wrath one. I think that was the one that I really enjoyed as well before this one.
Right. Mm. Right. I mean, so far, the only thing I've heard from Mists of Pandaria is the login screen stuff and the character creation window stuff. So I'll have to check that out. And $9 for an orchestral soundtrack is a steal. I'm like you. I really like listening to orchestral stuff. I have a lot of it. A lot of it was like, you know, Star Wars CDs or stuff that I used to buy. Lord of the Rings, I've got the CDs for all of those movies when they first came out. And I mean, it was before digital, you know, downloads and iTunes stuff really took off and became mainstream. And those CDs were like $35 a piece.
Mm.
They're long, but they're really pricey. I love them. I don't regret the purchases, but just compared to like, you know, some pop or country album for $12, you're just like, oh, damn it. Why must I have such good taste? Damn you, art world. All that kind of good stuff. But I know a lot of artists actually listen to orchestral soundtracks and movie scores and video game stuff when they're working. Peyton, do you still listen to comedy when you draw? Or have you switched over to music?
No, I listen to a lot of comedy and stuff. And just kind of radio stations or whatever. Yeah,
yeah, it's funny how everybody kind of has their zone. You know, when they're at work, they've got to get stuff done and there's music. Like, you don't necessarily want like radio that's going to interrupt you all the time, but sometimes you just need that groove in the background that can just kind of be
I listen to the comedy stuff when I have all my heavy lifting done for whatever I'm working on. So the storyboarding, all that stuff's finished, and I'm just, you know, point A to point B stuff, right? Otherwise, right. I got one album I listen to a fair bit, and it's Sigur Rós, and it's like an Icelandic group.
Yes, I think you told me about that before.
Yeah, back when I was in college, one of my instructors, Jordy, in electron class, put it on. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, so sort of got hooked on it there. So it's good because it's, you know, there's vocals in it, but, you know, it's not in English. I have no idea what he's saying. So in your mind, you don't even listen to that. You don't know that out of your head. So
you're just listening to notes and tones and rhythm and stuff. Yeah. Yeah. That's why I like jazz so much, because what little dialogue or lyrics there are in jazz, it tends to be pretty repetitive, especially in blues. For that matter. But right on. Well, I guess I can talk a little bit about email for the show. We don't actually have a message to share with everybody this week, but I can tell you how you can send us one, and that is thecitadelcafe@gmail.com. That's our email address, has been since we started the show 36 episodes ago. And it's a good way to send us any idea that you have for the show, whether it's a show that you want to, like a movie or a television show you want to recommend that we check out, a website or a comic book or art site. I mean, just last week I recommended a DeviantArt page. I mean, I would love to have people write us and say, hey, have you seen this guy's crazy cool DeviantArt stuff? Because I'm trying to teach myself how to paint digitally, and the more stuff I can soak up, the better. You can also send a voicemail if you'd like to speak with us, not so much in person, but through the miracle of time and space. You can send a voicemail to thecitadelcafe@gmail.com. MP3 format, try to keep it under 1 minute if at all possible. And if you're not feeling overly verbose, you can always just send us a line on Twitter, and that is thecitadelcafe on Twitter as well. And if you have anything important, make sure you hit it with a hashtag, because it makes it easier for us to find at the end of the day. That brings us nice and neat to the Internet Minute, which is where we have a couple of short, cool picks to share with everybody. Peyton, why don't you let her rip? See what's hanging in your pick pack this week.
Two little quick picks. One is a video of Mario Goes Berserk. We've talked a fair bit about video games this episode, and I think this is appropriate. People wonder what Mario might do with the axe in the game, and it shows what he would do. You know, killing turtles, et cetera, et cetera. And actually killing things, which is kind of fun. And, you know, so if you want to, you know, it's good for a chuckle, not necessarily a belly laugh, but you might get a chuckle out of it. And right, the other pick is something for Joel, and as well as Ryan, as you know, I'm sure you're familiar with Calvin Hobbes. But Bill Watterson, he doesn't really put anything out on the market from his original artwork. And there's a Sunday strip that he did a few years ago for Red Rover creator, and that he actually gave to him. Anyway, it's now coming on the market. So there's going to be an auction coming up. Opening bid starts on the 27th of October. The auction happens between the 15th and 16th of November. And yeah, they're saying that one of his original watercolors for a calendar was auctioned off for $107,000.
Oh, my God.
And last summer, an original painting he did, wall painting of cul-de-sac character Petey, was sold for $13,000. So they'll probably go for a fair penny. It's a real nice strip there. And he's just, you know,
wow,
one of those, like, you know, you see things like, oh, yeah, I'd love to get one of the pieces of work. And then you realize, you know, everybody else wants to have it too, right? Like, you know, yeah, I'd love to get my hands on an original Frank Frazetta or something like that, but that's not going to happen.
No. It's crazy how art and value have this really strange relationship. Like, if Calvin and Hobbes was still being drawn today, if he had been drawing it for the last 40 years and there was this huge volume of work, would this still be worth, you know, an estimated $100,000 or more?
Well, I guess perhaps, you know, because, you know, if he doesn't put the stuff into the market, you know.
But I mean, could you last 40 years and not sell something? Like, I don't know. Yeah. It's an interesting thought. You know, it's like you hear about, you know, Picasso paintings or Van Gogh paintings that, I mean, obviously get traded around for millions of dollars. Yeah. And the artists at the time were starving to death. You know, they couldn't pay their rent with a painting.
Yeah.
You know, because they were too forward thinking. You know, it's like, you're not painting, you know, stuff that we want to buy. You know, just stop being so weird. And yet, you know, a 100 years later, 150 years later, it's all like absolutely priceless. So it's always a strange headspace in terms of.
And what will happen as well, like down the road, once, you know, these people pass on, of course, it goes up even more in value, right? So.
Yeah.
I was just thinking, like, you know, having original art and stuff. Again, the same structure with the Sigur Rós. He was saying he was at a friend's place, walking along the hallway, drinking a very nice bottle of wine. He looked up on the wall, and there was like probably six different Al Hirschfeld drawings on the wall. He's like, "Oh, those are nice prints." And there's like, "Those aren't prints." Apparently, this guy's uncle used to work with Hirschfeld.
Oh my God!
He had like, you know, like half dozen originals in the house. And they were like, "Okay,
what?" Very cool.
Anyway,
that's crazy. Crazy, crazy. Well, it's funny that you mentioned art, because both my picks this week have to do with art, but not comics or painting like I did last week. The first is actually a YouTube video, and some clever son of a gun has recreated Escher's waterfall in real life.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
It is a wicked video. There's no explanation that I could find. It's just a simple demonstration of an optical illusion, very well put together. He even looked like he was quite happy that it worked. I'm not sure if he tested it before he decided to film it, but it worked brilliantly and baffles the mind. And actually, I believe it was Brad Kayford that had that up on Facebook.
I think he did.
That's how I caught that. And that was a very, very cool watch. So the link is going in the chat room right now, but also will be in our show notes, as with all of these links at the end of the show. The next one is something that I caught on Google Plus, and it is a really, you know, I have a kind of a love-hate relationship with the American brethren to the south, because of all the election stuff that happens. It feels like every time you're talking about U.S. news, it's always you know, election back and forth. But this particular post is about 50 states and 50 photos. And it's not necessarily just like an aerial photo of the state. There's some very artistic choices. They're big, beautiful, well-shot photos of the U.S. And it kind of reminds you why everybody that lives down there is so damn patriotic, is, you know, in love with whatever state or whatever city or whatever place that they call home down there. And it was a nice refresher from all the Romney, we want to open windows in airplanes crap that was filling the interwebs this week. And I caught this on Google Plus, and it's just beautiful, beautiful stuff. So, I mean, I find by the end of it kind of going, you know, I could live in one of these states. I can't remember which one. I think it was Nebraska. One of them was really picturesque. And I was like, man, like I could do that. I could deal with retiring there if that was the situation. I mean, like, my mother snowbirds down to Florida. She's a half American now. But it's really, really pretty, pretty, pretty stuff. And Bobbert is making fun of me in the chat room. Yes, Nebraska. No, it's not Nebraska. I don't know which one it is. It was one of the states where I thought, well, this is going to be boring, and it was not a boring picture at all. It looked actually quite nice. So that's it for me. Ryan, what are your picks this week?
I picked both videos. The first one is an IGN video. They've been doing these sort of retrospective videos before, like, a big sequel comes out. And in the video game industry, with six or seven sequels spanning 15 years, especially with the Resident Evil series, very confusing storyline. If you miss a game, or even if you play all the games, it's really hard to tell what is going on. So in 5 minutes, they explain the whole series. It's very spoiler-filled. So if you've missed a game or trying to catch up for the sixth one, which comes out next week, you probably want to avoid it. But watching this video will give you the story, and it actually makes it seem almost understandable, which is weird because the story is very convoluted. And the other one is related to the upcoming release of the Hobbit movie.
Ooh,
and
I'm all ears.
Yeah, I picked this one for you guys. I figured I'd turn back around.
There's a Hobbit movie? What?
Yeah, and there's a video game too, but... Oh, okay. This one deals with a celebration. I think it's the 75th anniversary of the Hobbit book. And Andy Serkis actually read a part of the Hobbit to some kids in somewhere in the UK. And he actually does it in the voice of Gollum. Mm-hmm. I think maybe he's either putting on the character while he's reading the character. But it's a short clip. And it's really interesting to just watch these kids just watch Andy Serkis make the voice, and there's some explanation into there, like what it's like getting back into the Gollum character after geez, he says 12 years, and I almost had to check my watch. I'm like, what, 12 years? Yikes. So, this video is very interesting.
Yeah, cool. I guess they started filming in 97, I think, is when, or maybe that was pre-production. But I think they started filming quite a while before the movies were released. Like, they took a long time to make, like, longer than most movies.
Yeah. Then the second two back-to-back. And I love the fact that they still shot extra footage of the third one after they'd won the Oscar for the DVD release.
Wow. Yeah, well, I mean, I'm certainly on board after watching. We mentioned it last week on the show, but after mentioning watching that the extended trailer, the new trailer for The Hobbit with Jocelyn last week, I'm really excited because I was kind of feeling bummed the other day about like, I gotta wait till next year for Superman, and there's no real good movies coming out. But the winter movie draft there on Framerate really kind of reminded me like about The Hobbit. There's a James Bond movie coming out this fall. Like, there's quite a few movies that I would actually like to go see in the theater before Christmas. So I'm excited to have the chance to go do that now. So right on. Well, that's very cool. I'm a big Andy Serkis fan. I like his work, so to speak. So we will have all those links in the show notes for everybody at home to go check those out as well. I'm sure, actually, if you could probably Google Andy Serkis reads Hobbits to kids, you'll probably find that right away. Probably something that's probably getting a lot of traffic these days. Well, that brings us nice and neat to the end of this episode of the Citadel Cafe. Music for the show was composed by Kevin MacLeod. We record the show live every Wednesday night at 7:30 Eastern on starcrossedonline.com. The podcast, of course, is available on demand via iTunes and our website post-haste after the show and after I have a chance to edit it. Stop by the show blog, thecitadelcafe.com, for the show notes that I have been mentioning. And we post links to pretty much everything that we plan to talk about every episode. Email, as we mentioned, is thecitadelcafe@gmail.com. And our Twitter, Facebook, and Google Plus handles are all thecitadelcafe, all lowercase, all one word. One of the best ways for the podcast to reach new listeners, besides you tapping your friend on the shoulder and telling them, hey, what are you doing? You should listen to the Citadel Cafe, is the iTunes store. If you want to go to the store, leave us a review. We'll give you a shout out on the show for spreading the word. It's one of the best ways for the podcast to reach new listeners. So if you have not yet, please go leave us a review. And we encourage constructive criticism too. Like, just don't give us an empty 5-star. If you think we're only good to 4.5, well then tell us why. As I mentioned at the top of the show, and now at the bottom of the show, my name is Joel Duggan, and you can find me and pretty much all that I'm up to on starcrossedonline.com. And you can find my new book, Starcrossed Volume 1, at indiegogo.com/starcrossedvolume1. There are only 8 days left to take advantage of the perk packages that are up there for an original sketch from me, an artist edition of the book. And if you're just interested in the book, there's a $10 package for just the book. All of which will be going out in October. I'm sending the files to the printer this week. I'll be sending them to be printed as soon as the campaign is finally closed and Indiegogo sends the money my way. And the book will be launching on October 26th at HellCon 2012 here in Halifax. And last but not least, you can follow me, Joel Duggan, on Twitter and Google+. Peyton, where can people find you online?
My website's cardboardtrios.com. I'm on the Twitter and the Facebook and all the other fun stuff. And how about you? How about you, Ryan? Where can people find you and the fine work?
Well, you can follow me personally at R. Murphy on Twitter. And as gets mentioned multiple times in the show, Gamers Inn. I know Jocelyn, used to do the show notes for Citadel Cafe, but
she's been really busy. She hasn't had time, so I've been picking up for her. But yeah, well, I mean, you guys normally record on Wednesdays. But that's been bumped. I have an inside scoop. So when are you recording next and what's in store?
We are recording next on Saturday and, we're going to be talking, I don't know what we're talking about, but we're obviously going to be talking about what we're playing. And we are going to be giving away a copy of World of Warcraft as well as the 3 expansions up to Cata. So you'll still need to purchase MOP or Mists of Pandaria, if you want to play as a panda. But we are going to be giving away, I believe, 2 sets. So the first set this weekend and the second set when Terpster is going to be on our show on the 13th of October.
Fantastic.
And actually, related to you, Joel, we another project I'm a part of is Zombies Ate My Podcast. And you actually did the art for us.
I did. Was super, super fun project, by the way, man. I appreciate being brought on board to do that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we're having a lot of fun. We just posted our second episode, and it's with the Fanboys XL guys, Rick and Bob, as well as Lou, who's a big fan of TCC and all things Frog Pants. And you can find out more at zombiesatemypodcast.com.
Awesome. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to the Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only pick two.